Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is side one of For the Record program number 553, titled The First Refuge of a Scoundrel, Part 2. This has been recorded on May 14th of the year 2006. The title of the program refers to For the Record program 430, The First Refuge of a Scoundrel, which in turn is a slight corruption of a statement that Dr. Johnson, a contemporary of Shakespeare's, made when he said that, quote, patriotism is the last refuge of a scoundrel. Well, I think there's a lot of truth to that, but the first refuge is usually religion. Usually when all else fails, they said, I did it for country. But more often than not, the very first thing that the scoundrel says is, I did it for God. I did it in the name of, pick the deity of your choice. And what we're going to be doing in this program, to a considerable extent, is updating the relationship between some elements of Buddhism and fascism. Now, in For the Record programs 547 through 550, we took a look not only at the Dalai Lama and his milieu as part of a covert action milieu that is involved with apparently fracturing not only parts of Indochina, but also parts of the former Soviet Union into smaller states using, quote, native, unquote, peoples. The Dalai Lama's brand of Buddhism, Tibetan Buddhism, has certain features which lend themselves well to a fascist construct. And we're going to take a look now at Zen Buddhism and how it, too, has been corrupted to a fascist construct. Now, I once again want to give a very, very emphatic caveat. I am not saying that Buddhism is fascist any more than when I talk about the Muslim Brotherhood, a fascist element in the Islamic faith. I'm saying Islam is fascist, or when I talk about the Likud party and the fascist element in the Zionist movement, not in the Jewish faith per se. I'm saying that Judaism is fascist, or when I talk about, for example, Opus Dei, a fascist subgroup within the Vatican that wields a lot of power. I'm not saying that Catholicism is fascist. However, there are features of many of the world's religions that have lent themselves very well to a fascist construct. And in the case of the Dalai Lama, an individual who appears to have been fundamentally, whose reality appears to be in many important respects in a state of fundamental contradiction with the popular image, that of an all-enlightened man of peace. How many all-enlightened men of peace do you know hang out with SS officers? In the 1990s, no less. Just as that is the case with the Dalai Lama, so too certain features of Zen Buddhism have lent themselves well to a fascist construct. And specifically, what we're going to be looking at in much of this broadcast is the use of Zen by not only Japanese imperialism, but in particular by the Japanese wars of aggression conducted in Japan's fascist period from 1931 until the end of the war. At least some of the people we're going to talk about here appear to have continued to manifest that philosophy after the end of World War II. But again, lest I be misunderstood here, I do not want to be misunderstood as saying that Buddhism is fascist. That is certainly not the case. In fact, I myself have been significantly influenced by certain features of Buddhism, and so I know of whence I speak here. Nonetheless, it is very, very important in coming to understand fascism to realize that there are many things that can be used in a fascist way. There are many philosophies that can be refined or distilled in order to arrive at a fascist construct, or corrupted in order to arrive at a fascist construct. That is the case with Buddhism, and when one sees the Dalai Lama working, for example, in conjunction with Islamists, pan-Turkists, and other native peoples, including Native Americans such as the Lakota, as part of the UNPO, an apparent kinder, gentler, covert action milieu headed up by the Habsburgs, we're looking at something very different. We're not looking at Muslims here or Buddhists. We're looking at fascism. And I think by way of helping to broaden our understanding of how the enlightened philosophy of Buddhism can be adapted to a fascist construct. We're going to take a look at a very good book review of a book published in 1998 called Zen at War by a gentleman named Brian Victoria. There is a very good book review of this by a fellow named Josh Barron, B-A-R-A-N. It is online. The title of the book review on at least one website, and there are several, is Zen Holy War. The full URL will be available in the description for this program. I'm going to read the review in its entirety. It will give people, I think, a very, very good understanding of the book, because obviously I just can't read the whole book on the air. Here, then, is a very good accounting of how certain features of Zen Buddhism and certain key philosophers within the Buddhist philosophy, of the Zen Buddhist philosophy, have lent their support to Japanese fascism and militarism. Again, this is a review of the book Zen at War by Brian Victoria, published in softcover by Weatherhill in 1997. The review reads, "Think of holy wars and Western religions come to mind. The God of Exodus orders the extermination of the Canaanites, instructing his chosen people to show them no pity," unquote. The commandment, "Thou shalt not kill," did not apply to slaying Gentiles. In 1095, Pope Urban II ordered crusaders to Jerusalem to kill the enemies of God, unquote. In 2 days, Christian soldiers slaughtered 40,000 Muslims who were merely non-human filth, unquote. "Wonderful sights," one crusader reported. "Piles of heads, hands, and feet. It was a just and splendid judgment of God that this place should be filled with the blood of unbelievers," unquote. And even now, Islamic terrorists proclaim God is great as bombs explode in the Middle East. On the other hand, Buddhism has always been portrayed as the religion of peace. Quote, "There has never been a Buddhist war," unquote, I've heard many times over the years. When the Sakya kingdom was threatened with invasion, the Buddha sat in meditation in the path of the soldiers, stopping the attack. When the Indian king Ashoka converted to Buddhism, he curtailed his military escapades and erected peace pillars. When the Dharma came to Tibet, it is said that the barbaric tribes were pacified. Well, parenthetically, I think Mr. Barron needs to educate himself here about the realities of some of the manifestations of Tibetan Buddhism, as many others do. By the way, actually, I should once again inject parenthetically that in discussions of Zen, just as in discussions of the Dalai Lama and Tibetan Buddhism, one should not in any way view this analysis as casting aspersions on many, many individuals who have sincerely embraced Zen Buddhism in a very constructive way, just as there are people associated with the Dalai Lama and Tibetan Buddhism who are also altogether creative and constructive. That having been said, let us continue. "During the Vietnam War, Buddhist monks set themselves on fire to protest the fighting. And now, a new study emerges that will radically shake up this view of Buddhism. Zen at War is a courageous and exhaustively researched book by Brian Victoria, a Western Soto Zen priest and instructor at the University of Auckland. Victoria reveals the inside story of the Japanese Zen establishment's dedicated support of the Imperial War Machine from the late 1800s through World War II. He chronicles in detail how prominent Zen leaders perverted the Buddhist teaching to encourage blind obedience, mindless killing, and total devotion to the emperor. The consequences were catastrophic, and the impact can still be felt today. Most Western Buddhists will find this account heart and mind-boggling. Enlightened Zen masters supporting war contradicts everything we know about the Buddha's teaching. After World War II, the Japanese Zen tradition, like the nation itself, went into a collective amnesia regarding its complicity in the war. So over 50 years of Buddhist history have been hidden from outsiders and the Japanese themselves. They are just beginning to confront what happened. Zen at War could not have been written in Japan. To uncover this information demanded a person outside the Japanese world of loyalty who could dig deeply and ask uncomfortable questions. Victoria was urged not to publish his book. One Chinese priest suggested that it would slander the Dharma. But as Victoria rightly points out, the truth is never slander. Zen at War is a major contribution to understanding contemporary Zen and is a must-read, unquote, for all serious Dharma students. It may be the most significant Buddhist history book of the decade. In facing what Robert Aitken Roshi has called the dark side of our heritage, unquote, we are entering some very complex terrain. First, we need to understand the historical and cultural context. Secondly, we need the courage to explore the many uncomfortable and difficult questions this story raises. It would be easy to dismiss this as a Japanese wartime aberration that has long passed and would never happen again. That would be a mistake. There is a lot to learn here that could have profound effects as we grow as a Buddhist Sangha in the West. First, a little history. Buddhism became the state of religion of Japan during the Tokugawa era, 1600 to 1868. Nearly 500,000 temples were built. The Buddhist priesthood became an extension of the federal government. Every household had to be affiliated with a local temple. With such wealth and power came enormous liability. By the time the Meiji era began in 1868, there was growing popular huge resentment against Buddhism. A nationwide movement began to cleanse Japan of this foreign religion, unquote, and to reinstate Shinto as the only true Japanese tradition. Thousands of temples were closed, statues destroyed, and priests forcibly returned to lay life. The only way institutional Buddhism could survive was to become part of the new imperial system. According to Victoria, under the Shinto banner, the emperor was worshipped as a living god, the selfless wisdom of the universe, unquote. Imperial law and the Dharma were seen as identical, imperial way Zen as opposed to the Buddha way Zen. Basically, the emperor replaced the Buddha, the Japanese spirit and loyalty replaced the Dharma, and the nation replaced the Sangha. Zen teachings were adapted to conform to the new tradition. A famous Zen soldier wrote, "Seeking nothing at all, you should simply completely discard both body and mind and unite with the emperor," unquote. As the century began, Japan was emerging from hundreds of years of isolation. In many ways, this war mind began in 1894 with the Sino-Japanese War and the Japanese victories in China and Korea, and later successes in the Russo-Japanese War of 1904-5. Japan's national pride inflated and they yearned to be a first-class nation, unquote, a modern world power that would counter Western expansion and create its own empire in the East. This island nation's isolation bred an all-pervading arrogance. Japan saw itself as divine, racially and culturally superior, flawless, unquote, and the only Buddhist country, unquote. Non-Japanese were called Jamagedo, unruly heathens. Japan was saving Asia, unquote, by spreading the pure Japanese Yamato Dashii, which took on cosmic proportions. Japanese Zen, especially the Rinzai lineage, had long been linked to the samurai culture in Bushido, the way of the sword. For hundreds of years, Zen masters trained samurai warriors in meditation, teaching them enhanced concentration and willpower. Zen helped them face adversity and death with no hesitation, to be totally loyal and act without thinking. To put it bluntly, Bushido was a spiritual way of killing infused with Zen philosophy. The sword had always been a Buddhist symbol for cutting through delusion, but under Bushido it was taken literally, evolving from metaphor into concrete reality. The sword became an object of veneration and obsession, idealized and worshipped. At the beginning of the century, Bushido was permeating Japan, the samuraiization of the nation, unquote. Now it expanded from feudal villages and local temples to the battlefields of Manchuria and eventually Guam and Pearl Harbor. Victoria pinpoints Shako Soen, S-O-E-N, 1859-1919, as one of the first Zen masters to enthusiastically embrace war as Zen training. Well known as D.T. Suzuki's teacher, Soen is revered in the history of Buddhism in the West as the first Zen teacher to visit the United States. In the war against Russia, Soen served as a chaplain in 1904. Quote, "I wish to inspire," Soen later wrote, "our valiant soldiers with the ennobling thoughts of the Buddha so as to enable them to die on the battlefield with confidence that the task in which they are engaged is great and noble. I wish to convince them that this war is not a mere slaughter of their fellow human beings, but that they are combating an evil, unquote. From Soane's point of view, since everything was one essence, war and peace were identical. Everything reflected the glory of Buddha, including war. And since the Buddha's main purpose was to subjugate evil, and since the enemy of Japan was inherently evil, war against evil was the essence of Buddhism. In the present hostilities, Soane wrote, into which Japan has entered with great reluctance, she pursues no egotistic purpose but seeks the subjugation of evils hostile to civilization, peace, and enlightenment, unquote. Japan's invasion of Russia was entirely self-serving and hardly reluctant. To Soane, war was, quote, an inevitable step toward the final realization of enlightenment, unquote. Soane uses the phrases just war and holy war, unquote. Japan was engaged in a war of compassion, unquote, fought by Bodhisattva soldiers against the enemies of Buddha. As Rinzai Zen Master Nontembo, 1839 to 1925, preached, there was, quote, no Bodhisattva practice superior to the compassionate taking of life, unquote. Soane considered any opposition to war as, quote, a product of egotism, unquote. Reading these words now, they seem clear examples of disturbed religious thinking. Parenthetically, I would add, I don't think it requires a great deal of effort to see how other religions have embraced the same sort of deadly, annihilating rationalization. And in so doing, they corrupt that religion, and that religion so corrupted becomes the first refuge of a scoundrel. Continuing with Baron's Pay review of Victoria's book, Buddhist teachings, language, and symbols, like any religion, can be perverted and twisted to support nationalism and violence. It is important to note that Soane is not some fringe crackpot. He is still almost worshipped in Japan as one of the great, fully enlightened, unquote, Zen masters of our time. Shodo Harari Roshi is a Rinzai teacher and abbot of Shogenjai, the largest Zen temple in western Japan, located in Okayama. He has dedicated his life to providing traditional Zen training to Westerners. Since his Zendo has both men and women, he is considered outside the mainstream. The presence of women disqualifies his temple from issuing formal priest certificates. He is clearly not interested in being part of the official system and will soon be moving his community to Whidbey Island near Seattle. We are having bitter green tea on a cold March morning discussing Zen and its wartime record. This has been a big issue for him. Harada's teacher, Yamadi Mumon, 1900 to 1988, was the chief abbot of Myoshinji, the great Rinzai head temple. Mumon's teacher was Seki Sasetsu, 1877 to 1945, a highly respected Zen master and a war champion. Saitetsu authored a book promoting Zen and Bushido. Just before the fall of Nanking, Sasetsu went on national radio to say, showing the utmost loyalty to the emperor is identical with engaging in the religious practice of Mahayana Buddhism, unquote. This is because Mahayana Buddhism is identical with the law of the sovereign, unquote. He then called for the extermination of the red devils, i.e. communists, both in Japan and in China. Saisetsu carried his message to the battlefield, visiting the Chinese front in 1938. Throughout the war years, Mumon served his master, accompanying him on his military trips and editing his writings. After the war and Saisetsu's death, Mumon began to express sorrow about his participation in the war. Quote, he told me that nothing he could ever do could make up for his complicity, Harada says, again quoting, everywhere he went, he talked about peace. He traveled to many places where Japan had caused suffering, Guam, Borneo, the Philippines, to talk about peace, unquote. Mumon never criticized his master Sasetsu, but saw his repentance as a personal campaign for peace. Harada, who grew up after the war, sees the entire Zen lineage in the shadow of this betrayal of basic Buddhist principles. He agrees that Zen's war complicity must be thoroughly be explored, or we will have learned nothing and the root causes will reassert themselves. He is direct and honest. Although he wants to explain the historical context, he makes no excuses for what happened. He feels that the head temples must take the lead in this, but I can tell by the tone of his voice that he really doesn't think this will ever happen. Over and over, he says, "This is a big problem, a big problem," unquote. Victoria identifies Sawaki Kodo, 1880 to 1965, as one of the great Soto Zen patriarchs of this century, as an evangelical war proponent. Serving in Russia as a soldier, he happily related how he and his comrades had gorged ourselves on killing people, unquote. Later, in 1942, he wrote, "It is just to punish those who disturb the public order. Whether one kills or does not kill, the precept forbidding killing is preserved. It is the precept forbidding killing that wields the sword. It is the precept that throws the bomb," unquote. The precept throws the bomb, unquote? This is an astonishing abuse of Zen language. Kodo also advocated, as did other Zen teachers, that if killing is done without thinking, in a state of no mind or no self, then the act is an expression of enlightenment. No thinking equals no mind equals no self equals no karma. In this bizarre equation, the victims are always left out as if they are irrelevant. Killing is just an elegant expression of the koan. When Colonel Aizawa Saburo was being tried for murdering another general in 1935, he testified, "I was in an absolute sphere, so there was neither affirmation nor negation, neither good nor evil," unquote. This approach to Zen is ultimately a perverse narcissism or even nihilism. Of course, the obvious question that was never asked, if there is no self, why is there any need to kill? Victoria has brought to light the actual words of these leaders and the written record of this period. Zen at War contains dozens of similar passages from leading teachers, proving that this distortion was the rule, not the exception. There were some pacifists, but they were few. Some priests who opposed the war may have quietly retired to distant country temples, but they probably left no record. Shunryo Suzuki Roshi, Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, the founder of the San Francisco Zen Center, reportedly was involved with some anti-war activities during World War II. But according to David Chadwick, who was writing a book on Suzuki's life, the record is confusing and at most his actions were low-key. The noted Zen writer D.T. Suzuki's early writing reflected the influence of Soen's teachings. To be fair, by 1940, Suzuki had changed his tune considerably. In 1896, as the war with China began, he wrote, quote, "Religion should first of all seek to preserve the existence of the state," unquote. Like his teacher, he saw the enemies of Japan as unruly heathens, unquote, who needed to be tamed and conquered, or who would otherwise, quote, "interrupt the progress of humanity." In the name of religion, our country could not submit to this, unquote. Going to war, he called religious conduct, unquote. Suzuki used poetic language in praise of Japanese soldiers, quote, "Our soldiers regard their own lives as being as light as goose feathers, while their devotion to duty is as heavy as Mount Taishan in China. Should they fall on the battlefields, they have no regrets," unquote. This metaphor of goose feathers, unquote, would become a major point of military indoctrination, teaching recruits and the young kamikaze, divine wind pilots, that their individual lives were meaningless and had no weight. Only total devotion to the emperor would give their existence meaning. Suzuki also popularized the Bushido concept of the sword that gives life, unquote, that was used over and over again to rationalize killing. Years later, the Japanese ambassador would use this phrase on the sword that gives life in a speech at Hitler's chancellery in Berlin following the signing of the Tripartite Pact on September 27, 1940. Victoria points out that all Buddhist sects supported the war publicly and enthusiastically. If they didn't, the consequences would have been severe, especially in a country that values loyalty to the group above all else. Victoria provides numerous examples. Both Rinzai and Soto leadership were active in providing spiritual support to the military leadership and the soldiers at the front. Many well-known generals were private Zen students of famous Roshis. Zen priests were sent to the front as chaplains and missionaries. Sojiji, the Soto head temple, organized a sect-wide project to handwrite over 10 million copies of the Heart Sutra, some in blood, to generate merit for the war effort. Most Zen students are familiar with the formal dedication of merit, Ekoban, after sutra recitation. Both traditions change their Ekoban to pray for the continuing victory in the holy war, unquote, and, quote, unending military fortune, unquote. The Soto sect raised money for two fighter planes, aptly named Soto No. 1 and Soto No. 2. Not to be outdone, the Rinzai head temple of Myoshinji contributed three fighter planes to the Imperial Navy. The Bodhisattva of Compassion, Kanzeon, was officially renamed Kanzeon Shogun, unquote, and invoked to bring greater victory in the holy war, unquote. This would be the equivalent of renaming Jesus Christ Jesus General. Kyoto Hanazono University, Institute for Zen Studies. I am meeting with Masataka Toga, the director of the institute and one of Mumon Roshi's other successors. Hanazono is the Rinzai University, and the institute is an official clearinghouse for their 14 head temples. The war period, Toga says, is the most painful topic. I wish I never had to think about it, unquote. For some years, he has talked about it, but in a quiet, personal way. He participated in a few academic conferences. The Rinzai sect has never spoken officially or publicly about its wartime activities. When we talk about how the Rinzai sect could discuss this more openly, we enter into something of a clash of cultures. I ask him if there would ever be a sect-wide meeting or articles written on the war. That is just not the way it works in Rinzai, he explains. With so many head temples, there is no single approach or forum to address an issue like this. There will be no open exchange. And the war is too recent, he says, too alive, unquote, and too fresh, unquote. It would be disrespectful to their senior priests to talk of such matters while they are alive. In any case, such discussions would be on a private level. We're going to continue with this paper itself, I think, altogether enlightening. By the way, the review is Zen Holy War. It's a book review of the book Zen at War by Brian Victoria, published by software by Weatherhill. The review is by Josh Barron, and we're going to pick up with this inside two of the program. Now, I can't stress strongly enough that listeners should take advantage of the vast and growing amount of material that is available both in print and on audio files online. At this point, if you're only listening on air, you're missing the greater part of the For the Record experience. www.spitfirelist.com has a vast amount of printed material, long article-length descriptions of each For the Record broadcast, links to websites with the documents about the Bush family's involvement with Nazi industry before, during, and after the war, a blog forum, lecture files, and links to two websites maintained by sister station WFMU that is archiving the For the Record shows on audio. Please take advantage of the information available online, both in print and on audio files, as it is essential and I think will greatly flesh out your understanding. By the way, this is a very pedantic format that I use on this program. I realize that. If people who listen and want to find out more or missed something or want to know what my sources are, please, people, use the printed descriptions because it's all there. Often, there is information in the printed descriptions that is not in the broadcast itself due to the limitations of time. www.spitfirelist.com, www.wfmu.org/Dave Emery, or some of the websites. There are many others. At this point, I've got approximately a dozen anti-fascist books available. There's a search function on the website. And last, but certainly not least, there's a page to access in order to support the work that I'm doing. And if you don't like the things that you're hearing, there's no better way of fighting back than supporting the work that I'm doing. This concludes Side 1 of For the Record Program number 553, The First Refuge of a Scoundrel, Part 2. This has been recorded on May 14th of 2006. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.